Okay, I have on the phone with me a gentleman who is responsible for a book that has become very sought after in the old-time radio collecting field. I'm talking about the book called Tune In Yesterday, and its author, John Dunning. Hello, John.
How are you?
Very good. And first of all, let's say thank you for joining us here in the Glowing Dial, taking some time out to talk to us.
Well, thank you.
A few questions we had written out here to ask you about the book and
okay.
yourself and everything. How long have you been into old-time radio, to start with?
I got my first tapes in 1969, and basically I'd heard about a collector here in Denver, and at that time I don't think there were more than about 300 shows or 600 or something like that in general circulation. There were some guys like Barry Brooks up in Boston area who were reported to have several, 20,000, up to 20,000, but, and Jim Harmon out in, California had many thousands of shows, but,
mm-hmm.
and Jim wrote the book, The Great Radio Heroes and The Great Radio Comedians, and I think he's still fairly active, but for the most part, at that time, there wasn't very much.
Well, that's it's grown considerably because I tell you, when I got into it myself in my late teens, this would be in probably the mid 70s or so. There wasn't a whole lot available to me at that point.
Yeah.
I got hooked on old time radio with Orson Welles and The War of the Worlds,
mm-hmm.
and you know from thereafter I was just trying to collect as much as I could. And
right.
At that time, I'm thinking, oh, there's a few old timers into collecting the old shows. There's not that many available, like you said, and boy, was I wrong.
Yeah, and what happened in the 60s, I mean, you know, in the late 60s, is that the stuff that was around was generally very poor quality. You know, a lot of it had been poorly saved and poorly recorded, and then you had a lot of collectors who were dealing with very poor equipment, and the method of operation at that point was to double track everything and double speed everything, so you could do theoretically, at least, you could do a 4-hour tape in 30 minutes.
Okay.
But of course you messed it up in the process.
Right.
A lot of people, I remember one fellow who claimed to have collected 60,000 shows back then, and you know, you just can't do that. If you don't listen to the stuff, what's the sense in collecting to it?
Correct.
You know,
yeah.
Or collecting it. So a lot of the sound quality has improved dramatically over the last 20 years.
Yes, it has.
You have guys going back to the original sources, the original discs,
right,
and redubbing them after somebody else had messed them up years ago, and those flawed copies were put into circulation, and then the problems were compounded when these guys with their old 1956 Webcores got a hold of them and double tracked them.
Right.
So I have actually heard shows that were both too sharp and muffled, and had crosstalk and
mm-hmm.
were fast, and you know, they had the whole range of program flaws. Thankfully, that's not as true today.
Yeah, well, you still do hear, I think, some of the crosstalk may be evident still on some of the transcription discs, because maybe it was just a poor transcription.
Yeah, that is less common, I think, than having somebody mess it up intermediately.
Right.
Especially the commercial dealers. I think what you find out with a lot of these guys, and, you know, there are some who are very conscientious, but I think a lot of the commercial dealers are in it for the money, and there isn't that much money to be made, and especially when you're supplying the tape. So I think they
right.
think if they can dub it as fast as possible, then they can cut back on their time. But what you get is a show that's really pretty flawed.
Yeah.
I haven't had to fool with dealers in a long time. I mean, I bought my initial 300 or 400 shows from a guy, and I never bought from another dealer after that.
Uh-huh.
I do have a little buy group here in Denver that buys from guys who don't sell to the public, but they have access to discs and so I trade them stuff for master discs when
mm-hmm.
they come in, disc dubs. But I don't know. I tell you, most of the dealer stuff that I hear has got some problems. You can tell it's several generations removed from the original source.
Right.
But it was a big thrill to hear this stuff again after mm-hmm. all those years. I mean, I grew up with radio. In the early 50s, I used to listen to Meet Corliss Archer and the Fat
uh-huh.
Man and all those shows, and it was a real thrill to hear them again. I got into it because of nostalgia.
Right.
And then I found out when I started listening to this stuff that some of it was very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, that was my feeling, too. I mean, I wasn't around. I'm only 35 right now, so I didn't really live through any of the golden days of radio at all, mm-hmm. so I didn't really hear anything as it went out on the network, except for maybe CBS Mystery Theater, you know,
yeah.
in the late 70s. But I discovered the magic of it very early on in my teens, and it's been with me ever since.
Uh-huh.
But getting into tuning yesterday, your book, you realize, maybe you may not realize, I told you when I talked to you before, this has become pretty much the Bible of old-time radio collectors.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, that's very flattering. I'm happy to hear that. I do hear that from time to time, and it really does make me aware of how many shortcomings there are in the book and why the book needed to be redone.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate when people say that, but it really was time to do something, some upgraded edition of it.
Right. But this current edition, I mean, it's been out of print for a number of years now. I think it originally came out in 1976, am I correct?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's fetching prices of, at least at the convention we were at, the fellow wanted $100 for it,
mm-hmm.
and we talked him down to 75.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But
it used to sell for more than that, and what happened was I think the radio crowd got wind of the fact that I had another book in the works, and that was really the first of my books that started fetching any real money at all,
mm-hmm.
and I'd seen prices of $250 and up.
Wow.
Back 6 or 7 years ago.
So we got a great deal then, didn't we?
Well, but what happened, see, is the price dropped on it because that was totally an old-time radio market. They didn't care whether they got the first edition or the second edition. I remember back then one book dealer got $65 for a paperback. And what the radio crowd wanted was they just wanted access to the information that was in the book.
Right.
There was even some dealer who was trying to sell photocopied pages of it at one of the conventions. I had a little talk with him on the
That's
phone.
That's a bit illegal, isn't it?
Yes, he didn't seem to understand. He was pretty irate and pretty belligerent. He didn't seem to understand that the difference between selling a first edition for $200 and selling a photocopied edition for $20.
Yeah.
And I explained what the law was to him, and I don't think he gets it till this day. but there is a difference. And the book, I'm gratified that I did it. I'm happy I wrote it. But over a period of time, there were some errors in it. When I started out to do it, I made a pact with myself there wouldn't be one single mistake in it. Well, I'm sorry, there were a number of mistakes in it.
You can't catch every single mistake. I mean, you know.
No. But we're trying on this one.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to be at least 2 to 3 times the book the other one was.
Whoa, that's great to hear. What kind of a job is it putting something like this together? I mean, like the original. When did you first start working on that, the first issue?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was going to tell you, in before we get to that, in connection with that, what has happened to the book as a collectible is that the radio guys stopped buying it when it became apparent that there was going to be another edition that was going to really pretty well eclipse the first one.
Uh-huh.
And then I started writing detective books. And what happened with I wrote a novel called Book to Die, which almost immediately became a collectible that really is selling for about $800 now. And what you're seeing now is that the prices on the radio book have after going down to sometimes as low as $50 after a high of about $250, are coming back up again.
Uh-huh.
And the reason they're coming back up again is because they're selling to detective and mystery fans who will never use the book. They don't care anything about old-time radio, and those folks will never buy anything but a first edition.
Right.
I mean, see, so it's the book has had a kind of an up and down life as a collectible book. Now, to get back to what you asked me, what was it again?
Well, what does it take to put something like this together? And like, when did you first start work on this first the Tune In Yesterday book?
It takes infinite patience and time, and I'll tell you how that came about if you've got time.
Sure.
But how I decided to do it, back about 6 years ago, maybe more than that, 7 or 8 years ago, I was very impressed with the need for a new edition, and I called my agent in New York, and I asked her what she thought the prospects were, and she said, well, it was possible to do it. And at that point, I wrote out the entries. I wrote a rough draft of the entries that I would put in the letter A, and the letter A alone ran 200 manuscript pages, and it contained shows that were not in the first edition at all, like the Atwater Kent Hour and the A&P Gypsies and many shows out of the earliest years of radio. And she marketed the book to many, many publishers in New York. Couldn't get any interest because the thing obviously was going to be a huge project. And we got turned down by just about everybody. And at the end of several years, she called me up and said, we're pretty much run the gamut on this with the exception of the university presses. And she said, the real ones are Oxford, Princeton, and Yale. And you know what the chances are at places like that. I mean, these places are very difficult to crack into. And I said, well, what have we got to lose? Let's send it to Oxford, which would have been the ideal publisher for it. I should have sent it there first. But lo and behold, Oxford upped and took the thing. They just said, we would love to do it. And we were back in business. And then I had to produce the book. And it has taken me, I just would not have imagined how much time. I sat down and I went through probably 300-400 issues of Radio Guide that were sent to me by other collectors. I Xeroxed all the articles and collated them into a kind of a vertical file, like when you get, and then I had a big long run of Radio Life. Radio Guide, I also Xeroxed the radio logs at the end that tells what was on the air and when and what time and who sponsored it. And so at the end I had literally a box of logs, and I had two or three filing cabinets full of articles. So when you come to a show like the Edgar Bergen Hour, you might have 20 pieces in there, 20 articles, and then I wrote it just that way. I just went alphabetically, and when I got there, I read the 20 articles or 30 or whatever there was on Bing Crosby or Edgar Bergen or anything. And then I wrote the piece and listened to some shows, and that's the way I did it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got done, I had a manuscript of 3,600 pages.
Wow.
Which I sent to Oxford, and when I sent it off, I kind of rolled my eyes at the heavens and said, the man is going to think he's dealing with a lunatic. When he opens, he's going to open this box, roll his eyes, and said, my God, I've got a madman on my hands, and he's going to seal it up and send it right back. Luckily, he didn't do that.
That's good.
I had never even heard from the fellow. I mean, I had been 2.5 years, 3 years on this project. I'd never had a letter from him. All of his dealings were with my agent in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And when I sent in the manuscript, she sent it over to him. She called over first and said, I got to warn you, this is big. And they said, well, how big can it be? You know, 1,000 pages, 2,000? And she said, keep going. And when he got it, he had it for a long time, several months. And then I got my first letter from him, and basically it said, well, this is very fascinating material, but my God, how long is this thing? And he just kept reading, and he wrote me one letter, and he said, the Bob and Ray material is fascinating. It's just wonderful stuff. And basically all I did was was tell how they got together at WHDH in Boston, and then I talked about some of the routines they did on the air.
Mm-hmm.
And finally we get down to brass tacks, and he said, well, I wish it were possible for us to publish this, but we have to keep it to one volume. That's a cardinal rule for this book. We cannot go into a second casing on the book.
Right.
And so he said, our maximum price for this book, our folks tell us, is going to be $49.95. And in order to do that, you're going to have to make cuts totaling at least 15%.
Wow.
And I took a look at the book, and I wrote him back, and I said, there is no piece of writing that I can't cut by 15%. I'll do it. And I'm not a computer guy. That meant running the entire manuscript through my typewriter again. And so I started about 2 years ago, and I started all over again with the letter A, and I virtually rewrote the book. I literally rewrote the book.
So you must have been typing 24 hours a day or close to it?
Well, you see, the thing is, in the meantime, Book to Die was published, and it became a very hot book, and they wanted a sequel. So you're right. I was writing all day long because I was doing a mystery novel at the same time.
Okay.
And I was working like 14-hour days, and I would come up and literally the world would spin. And it's not healthy to write like that.
Right.
And so at the end of the 2 years, what I had given him was a very loose, baggy manuscript, and I had given him at the end of the two-year rewrite a very tight, mean and lean 2,100-page manuscript, which is still sizable, still a big book. And you know what really makes me happy about the thing is that, you know, in getting that book down to 2,100 pages, I didn't lose any substance.
Mm-hmm.
And if I talked about how funny Bob and Ray were and gave seven anecdotes to that effect, I cut it to the best three.
Right.
And that's how I cut the book. I didn't cut any significant stuff out of it, and I got it down to a good tight book. We arrived on a format that it'll tell all of the broadcast history and who was on, who played it, and then there's a narrative section that talks about the impact of the show.
Mm-hmm.
It's got articles in it, like it's got eight or ten page section on band remotes, which wasn't in the original.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a section on religious broadcasting and news broadcasts.
Okay.
And when I say band remotes, I'm talking about there's a history of band music on the radio.
Right.
Same thing for news shows. It's got a section on the Metropolitan Opera, which wasn't in the first book.
Okay.
And on sports broadcasts. So I think that if you have a question that this book doesn't answer, I don't know it. I'm satisfied with the book now, and I'm ready to let the next level of knowledge or whatever you want to call it be done by somebody else.
Okay.
So.
Well, I mean, it certainly has been an exhaustive work for you, and I know you're very much respected for doing all this.
Well, I appreciate that. They've changed the title.
Okay. Title.
Oxford didn't like Tune In Yesterday. They thought it was gimmicky, so they came up with a title called On the Air, the Encyclopedia of Old Time Radio.
Okay, that fits.
And they are treating it as a new book.
Okay, very good.
Even though there is some stuff from the old book,
mm-hmm.
It's mostly been rechanneled and rewritten, so they're treating it as a new title.
There was a question my co-host Steve wanted me to ask here. As far as the new content in the new book, is there going to be anything covering any local programming, like programming that didn't really go out on the networks?
Only if it was nationally known in some way.
Okay.
I just really couldn't get into local radio because I just didn't.
That's a whole other area, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
And much more exhaustive than what you were now doing, too.
Yeah. What I did do are shows like the breakfast shows in New York, Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick, which was only on WOR,
uh-huh.
and the Children's Hour, I think was on WJZ, and shows like that that had a national reputation, even though they were only on locally.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I think the local thing is going to be have to be somebody else's job.
Okay, no problem there. In researching all this, did you actually do any travel interviews or
I didn't do any traveling to interview, but what I did do was when I was here in on radio, I did an old-time radio show here in Denver for 25 years.
Oh, did you? Okay.
And I had a show on a talk station, and I did about 125 or 30 on-the-phone interviews of up to 75 minutes with people who, many of whom are now dead.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that was worked into the book. I mean, I interviewed folks like Frank Nelson and Howard Duff.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I got Phil Harris on one time, and Fibber came on. He was a bear, I'll tell you. He was a tough
Jim
interview.
Jim Jordan. Yeah.
Yeah, he was really a tough interview.
Was he really?
He was cantankerous, and he wanted to argue about everything. And,
uh-huh.
And it took me about a half an hour, which is all the time he happened to have, to just to break the ice with the guy.
Oh, boy.
I mean, he was just crusty as he could be.
Hmm.
But some of the ones I remember as being wonderful, Dick Joy and I became real good friends, and Elliot Lewis became...
Oh, yeah.
He and I became really good friends. He used to call me at night. He was a mystery writer, too, you know.
He was a triple threat man, almost, wasn't
triple
he?
Triple threat man. I used that
actor,
term in the book.
Producer, director, writer?
Yeah, yeah.
That's four, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. If I were going to die and come back, I'd like to come back as Elliot Lewis in 1949 or 50. Norman Corwin. Corwin was another one who appeared on my show. I had him twice. I had George Balzer, who wrote for Jack Benny.
Mm-hmm.
But Elliot, the first time I called him, he was kind of like, almost like a hero figure, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't have hero worship because I'm getting kind of old myself now, and I was a reporter for the Post, and I can interview just about anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to tell you, when I called Elliot on the phone, I had a little bit of the shakes.
A little bit of stammering there?
Huh?
A little bit of stammering, huh?
Yeah, and he got on the phone. I think his wife, Mary Jane Croft, answered the phone, and
okay.
I asked if I could speak to Elliot, and he comes and gets on the phone, and I told him who I was, and he had never heard of me. I mean, even though I'd had a couple of mystery books out that were current at that point,
uh-huh.
He was writing a series of mysteries, paperback mysteries, about a detective named Bennett.
Okay.
And those are out of print, I believe, now. And when I told him I wrote mysteries, too, we hit off a correspondence then that actually he would call me sometimes at night, and he would tell me some of the problems he was having with his publisher. And when I asked him to come on my show, he said, sure. He said, what are you, can I talk about my books? And I said, you can talk about anything you want to talk about. And the first interview I had with him, we just went through about 45 minutes or an hour and just talked about things like Wells. He was on some of the Mercuries. And I kind of steered away from Kathy Lewis.
Yeah, he was married more than once then, wasn't he?
Yeah, well,
I didn't realize it was Mary Jane Croft was also...
Well, Mary Jane Croft was his wife for the last... She's been his wife for the last 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
But back in the 30s, back in the 40s and 50s, he and Kathy Lewis were known as Mr. and Mrs. Radio.
Yeah, yeah.
They did
a lot of stuff together, didn't they?
Well, they did Kathy and Elliot on Stage, which I think was a great show.
Mm-hmm.
And she was playing Jane on My Friend Irma. And
right.
She was doing a lot of Sam Spade and a lot of suspense. He was directing suspense. He was doing Phil Harris, Alice Faye show. And he was also writing, producing, directing Broadway Is My Beat and crime classics, and you know,
he's a busy man.
He was a busy man, so I know that he and Kathy had a kind of a bloody split up, and it was not really great. And when I called him back and asked him to come back again, I said, can I talk about Kathy Lewis? And he said, you can ask me anything you want to ask me. And he says, I don't know what I'm going to say, but we'll find out.
Mm-hmm.
And he got on the air, and I said, what can you tell us about Kathy Lewis? And he said, she was full of secrets.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, really? And he said, yeah, and he said, you know, for all of the Mr. and Mrs. Radio stuff, for all of the fact that we were kind of considered such a romantic team on the air,
right.
He says, I can barely remember what she looks like.
Ooh.
And I just thought, boy, that's fairly poignant, you know?
Yeah.
Another one I got was Paul Frees.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And I don't know of anybody else who has interviewed Paul Frees. He was a very formidable presence on the phone. I got his number from somebody, and I called him, and he answered the phone and said, yes, just like that. And I told him who I was, told him I wanted to interview him, and he said, the essence of it was, why should I do this for nothing? And it wasn't quite like that, but it was almost like that. And
yeah.
I told him that I just thought he had a lot of fans here, and I'd like to have him talk to them. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, if you call me at that time on Sunday, and if I'm here, I'll talk to you. And I thought, okay, I'll take that chance. So I called him on Sunday, and he was there, and within two minutes we had broken the ice, and he was just wonderful.
Well, that's one. That's interesting.
Just great. He was so much better than some of the others who you know, they put a barrier up between you, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But he talked about radio and about himself and Bill Conrad on Escape, and I asked him, you know, how did it feel to have a $1 million voice, and he said, you mean we've been downgraded, huh? And it was nothing bashful about him, I'll tell you that.
Okay, yeah.
And Parley Bear came on. Wonderful,
yeah.
Wonderful man. I became quite friendly with him. I sent him some of his shows. A great guy. I had Janet Waldo and Sam Edwards both on together talking about playing Corliss and Sam and Dexter
yeah.
back in the 50s. So it was fun.
Do you still have any of these interviews?
Oh, I kept them all.
Wow.
I kept them and I sent them to the Broadcast Pioneers Library in Washington. And most of them ran an hour. Some of them ran. I had Steve Allen on, and we would go nonstop because I was on Sunday afternoon, and I had no commercial time to break. I had a few commercials
right.
once in a while. But, but Steve Allen, I think I talked with him for 75 minutes nonstop. And
there may be a market for those. Have you ever thought of that?
Well, there may be, but my understanding of the copyright law is that I only own half of them.
Okay.
And they own the interesting half, which is their side of it.
I see.
So I would have to get their permission to use
a lot
them.
Of legalities involved in that, then.
Yeah, yeah.
But at least they're great memories for you, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it created a very tense show because we'd go on live, and, and Elliot would tell me, he said, you know, you're working without a net. I remember he said this to me on the air. He said, live radio, there's nothing like live radio.
It's yeah. just,
and he said, you don't have any idea what I'm going to say at this point, do you?
That's why I respect all the folks that were involved in it and did it.
Absolutely.
You know, even if you go into live TV, too, I look at a lot of these old shows, like
yeah.
the old Tales from Tomorrow or the old Lights Outs, or
right.
as they went to TV. I just have a great deal of respect for the folks that did that because you had to get it right.
Did you see they're going to do ER live? They're going to do the first broadcast of ER is going to be on live.
No, I did not hear that.
Now, that's really interesting because, and the cast, I guess, just decided that they want to do something different. Now, I don't know if you've ever watched that show.
No, I haven't.
Well, let me tell you, the emergency room in that show is fairly, shall we say, frantic.
Oh, okay.
And there's a lot of dolly work. And I'm just think that takes a lot of guts to do that.
Yeah, it does.
But anyway, it's going to make an interesting hour to see how they do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I just thought most of these folks were just superb. I had a few difficult ones, like Jim Jordan disagreed with everything and challenged everything, and I was just getting to him when he had to go.
Right.
John Houseman was just a bear. But Ray Bradbury came on and talked about some of the stuff that was adapted from his books, and he was just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I called Helen Mack at home, and I couldn't get her on the air. She was one of the great women directors in radio,
okay.
and I tried to cajole her into coming on with me, and she said, I really can't do this. And she said, I can't talk about those days. And I tried to tell her, I said, you know, I'm probably the most gentle interviewer you will ever see. I said, and she said, really? She said, I can't do it, I shouldn't do it, and I won't do it. And that pretty well was the end of that.
Uh-huh.
Some of these people were shunted aside by television in such a rude and brusque way.
Exactly, yeah.
You had a bunch of hotshots who came in and took over TV, and the radio folks were kind of disdained in the early years of television. Later it became a badge of respect to have worked in radio.
Yeah.
And that wasn't true in the beginning. But I found some really interesting people. I got a hold of a BBC technician who was up on the rooftops with Murrow during the Blitz.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, really interesting guy. I still have all that, and it, and a lot of it worked into the book, more than you wanted to know, right? But it was fun.
Yeah. Moving on to a different area here, do you ever attend any of the old-time radio conventions that are in the around the country?
I don't travel much. I don't go to conventions of mystery readers either, and I tend to stay home and work. I did go to the Spurdvac convention about 10 years ago, but I've never been to the one in New Jersey.
Okay, we were there for our first time last year. We're going again this year, and they've got a pretty good roster of folks going to be appearing there. So we're going to be doing our best to see if we can get some interviews with them.
Uh-huh.
The first one we actually did interview was Parley Bear, and
Parley's great.
He was at the very end of a long, tiring weekend for him, and he was just very gracious enough to sit down with us for a few minutes and let us ask him a few questions. So we were very grateful to him for that.
Yeah, I had him three times, and once with Georgia Ellis before she died, talking about playing Chester and Kitty on Gunsmoke.
Right.
This brings back a lot of memories. It's been 10, 15 years since I've done these things. Never have heard him again either.
Mm-hmm.
But I did Burn Surrey. I had sound effects men. It was Dr. Burn Surrey now. I guess he became a psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some I missed. I did get Eve Arden on. And she was gracious and all that, but she was kind of secretive. She didn't want to tell too much. She was working on her own book, and she didn't want to blow a lot of that off.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And the ones I didn't get that I wanted, I really would have loved to talk to Dick Crenna. He played so many great juveniles like Walter Denton from Armis Brooks.
Uh-huh.
And now, of course, he's a leading man type. A fairly aging leading man. I hope he's not listening to this, but, he'd probably admit that. I mean, all this stuff is 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And I got some really great newsmen. I had Eric Severide on, and he didn't want to come on, but I sent him some tapes of himself from the Italian battlefront in 44, and he was so moved by it, he agreed to come on for a half an hour and stayed the whole hour.
Very good.
And I got Charles Collingwood and Larry Lesser. So my interests in radio and my show were rather broad-ranging and sweeping. I wasn't confined to just the shoot-em-ups or the escapes. I know some people, if it's not escape with a bunch of ants eating somebody alive, they don't want to hear it,
Flanagan versus the ants,
yeah. One of the things that's just come out fairly recently is a big long run of Information Police shows, which I think is one of the great shows of all time, and America's Town Meeting of the Air. Those are panel discussions, but during the most volatile times of our history, some very heated things came up on those shows. Really interesting history on those things.
Yeah.
All you have to do is ask me a question, and I run on into the afternoon. So you just talk me side the head and say, shut up when you've had enough of this.
I wouldn't dare. I wouldn't dare. Do you have a projected issue date of the book?
Oxford thinks they're going to have books in the office by sometime in January, which would make it a March release. I don't think that's going to be possible the way we're going on it, because I have just now finished turning back to them the first 188 pages of proofs, and I still have something like 650 to 700 to read, and we still haven't finished reading the manuscript yet. So
I think
it's probably going to be later in the spring, but it'll be early. It'll be the first part of next year for sure.
That's good.
Everybody says, why does it take so long? The reason it takes so long.
Try doing it.
There's a good answer right there. But the reason it takes so long is because basically you've got one guy, me, writing a book the size of, if you see those Oxford companions to English literature and things like that, those books are usually done by 30 people.
Right.
And I'm not kidding. I mean, there's usually two editors with about 15 to 30 different writers. And I've written this book now twice, and I keep telling everybody it's not Oxford that's so slow, although they are too. It's me. I've taken my time. I don't want to have to look back at this book in 15 years and say, geez, I wish I had done it. if I wish I'd taken a little more time and made sure that was right.
Right.
I want the mistakes that are in the book. If there are going to be mistakes, and in a book like this, you pointed out yourself, you can't help but have some. But I want them to be honest mistakes, just things that I couldn't have known, rather than things that I didn't find out because I was too much of a hurry to get it finished.
Mm-hmm.
And Oxford feels the same way. I've never dealt with a publisher like them. Their attitude is, we don't care when we publish it. So usually when you getting a book published, they can't wait to get it out. But Oxford wants it to come when it's ready, and I respect that.
Well, that's good. We're all going to be looking forward to it, let me tell you.
Well, I hope you like it when it comes.
Or we are looking forward to it right now, let's put it that way.
So
at least we have the original issue to keep us entertained until the other one comes out.
Yeah. It's been a long haul, and I'm ready for it to be done. And what you have to do at the end of things like this is to not weaken and do something stupid just so you can get finished.
Right.
You know, you have to take your time and read those proofs and make sure that the digits are right, the dates are right, as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are some dates that are never going to be pinned down. You're familiar with the log Jay Hickerson did.
Oh, yes.
That came along just as we were finishing ours, and it was a great help in double-checking our dates.
Mm-hmm.
And in correcting a few of them. But we're still going to have probably 50 to 100 discrepancies with Jay, and that's, I told him, in the course of telling him, by the way, you have done an enormous service with that book. I mean, there's information in that book that is so arcane and so difficult to come by. But we're going to have some discreps, and that's going to be natural with books as big as mine and as big as yours.
Mm-hmm.
A nice man. He wrote me back and said he appreciated that, and he thinks I'm probably right about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's the one that runs the Friends of Old Time Radio Convention out in Newark. You probably knew that.
Yes, I did.
And we are probably going to put in our request and maybe see if we can get him on and talk to him about his achievements.
Yeah.
In the convention and all that.
We had a fellow who helped both of us, Ray Stanage. And Ray was an amazing man in terms of diligence. He would get in that New York Public Library and just root through microfilm.
Uh-huh.
And Jay, I think, has been very candid about the help that Ray gave him. And I have too. A lot of the same stuff that Ray did for Jay, he did for me. He sent me logs, and he sent me. He became great friends with the people over at CBS. CBS, by the way, has a programming division which is still very active, and you can call over there. John Behrens, who has been a great help, can find dates and spellings of names of people who might have slipped through the cracks otherwise. But it was Ray Stanage who did a lot of the footwork for Jay's thing and for mine.
Well, then we owe him a great debt of thanks, too.
Yeah, he died about two or three years ago, and it was the funniest feeling because he died on the subway, I believe. And 2 days later, I got a package from him containing a bunch of CBS press releases and log information. But even then, as good as Ray was, we double-checked him.
Right.
We went to the library, checked all the microfilm, because I want this thing to be right. As right as it can be, you know.
So, well, we've got total faith in you, John.
Well, there are some days when I start babbling in tongues after a 12-hour day that I think, geez, if this thing comes out sounding like English, I'll be lucky. But it's almost over now.
Well, I'm sure it's going to come out just fine, and like I say, we're all going to be looking forward to it. I want to thank you very much for taking the time here of being with us here on the Glowing Dial and answering our questions, and hope it's given you an opportunity to reminisce a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Bring
yeah.
back some memories to you.
Yeah, it has. And, you know, I appreciate your interest.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, John.
All right. Take care.
All right.
We'll see you.
All right. Bye-bye.